G'day guys, welcome back to another episode of Motorsport Republica with a very, very special guest, Australia's fastest ever road racer, Cam Donald. How you doing, mate?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on.
No, I appreciate it. We've been trying to do this for a while and have you on, so...
We have, and you only just up the road, so there's no excuse, really. Yeah. It's pretty easy, half an hour, so perfect.
Well, we've travelled long and far around Australia for stuff, but it's nice and easier with local tours, yep. So... Makes it good.
All you got to do is just battle the cold tonight and you're good.
It's a cold time of year. I would normally ride the bike, but no, I took the soft option and jumped in the car tonight.
That's fair enough.
Don't blame you. What are you riding?
Usually I've got a Triumph, 765 Street Triple, and I've also got a Harley, a Dyna. I really like that. Easy to ride slow, the Harley on the road, which is good to keep the license.
Yeah, it makes life a lot easier, eh?
Definitely.
So start us out, mate. We wanted to go back on a bit of a journey with you tonight. And how did you get into riding? Was it a young age? Was it a flat track like a lot of the races have come through?
Yep, just Warrandyte, just down the road here. Just grew up, you know, my dad rode. So my grandfather rode bikes. My nan's brother, like my great uncle, rode bikes. They all rode. All they ever talked about was bikes. You know, most of them did some racing, bit of club racing. They didn't have any money, so they didn't do much. But there was always bikes in the garage. So that's why. And then two older brothers that were riding, and then they started racing junior motocross. So, you know, I mean, with bikes in the shed and in my family, it was literally in my blood from a very young age. I started riding about five, and lucky that living down in Warrandyte there, we had paddock down the road and there was some land. So I could just tear around the paddock and ride from a very young age, just, you know, hand-me-down bikes, hand-me-down gear. But, yeah, on from a real young age.
Beautiful part of the world. So you've always lived there, always grown up there. That's awesome.
Yeah, about three generations. Our family's from there long before it was expensive to live there. So lucky to still be there. I've ended up taking a lot of my grandfather's block there. So we rebuilt myself and Kaz, my wife, and we got two kids. So, yeah, we've been there. Back there, rebuilt 6-7 years ago now. Time flies. But, yeah, nice. It's really good to put some roots down and sort of – yeah, it's cool having, you know, like my kids are going to primary school now and it's the same school I went to, which is kind of cool.
That is really cool. There must be something in the water out that way because you've had like the Hurstbridge and Warrandyte. It's always produced fast people. Like, I think Craig Lowndes out that way.
Peter Brock.
Yep. Myself. There's been a few people out that way. Obviously myself as well. So.
Missed the boat there. On the PlayStation,
yeah. Yeah, on PlayStation. I rip around the track on PlayStation.
There's been some really interesting, and Tuning for Speed's a really famous, well-known book published many years ago at Phil Irving. Really famous engine tuner that helped develop the famous, you know, Vincent engine. And he lived his final years or a long time in Warrandyte as well. So, yeah, it's lots of, it is. I mean, everywhere's got someone that's interesting, I guess. But, yeah, there's been a lot of reasonably quick people from cars and bikes from that side of town.
Something going on. I don't know what it is.
Maybe the water in the Yarra.
What was your first bike? What was your little hand-me-down? What's a little mini bike going around back then?
It was a little 78 model RM50.
Yeah, right.
And back then they were a lot 5-speed. Pretty much the equivalent of a 65 motocrosser now. So brutally angry little thing, little air-cooled. Sure. It was terrifying, actually. But, that was the first bike. So that was really good. And then from there moved up. I think my first bike I ever had that was bought for me was a secondhand XR100, which was brilliant.
Yeah.
Just a good bike to put a heap of hours on. Yeah. I don't know how many thousand kilometres I did around Warrandyte, whether it be through the river tracks or state parks, or could get away with a lot more then than you could now. But, a lot of hours spent on that bike.
You must know that place like the back of your hand now.
Knew all the getaway routes, that's for sure. From the rangers and the local coppers at the time. But, we were always getting chased or getting up to mischief. But we're lucky we could go out the backyard and sort of side saddle it up a road a bit, and then we're straight into there. Was quite a few areas of bush that were uninhabited and left alone that we could get away with riding in. So we're really blessed when I look back at having that as kids.
Yeah, that's right. It's better than just sitting around on an iPad these days, you know. Like, you can just go out and do whatever you want, you know. It's 100%. Easy. So much better.
And that's what I'm trying to do with my kids, even just me and my missus is a bit of a hippie at heart, but we're not real big on electronics or iPads in the house, or even, we've got one TV, but it was just really trying to get them outside. Yeah. I don't know. You can only fight it for so long, but the longer you can, I think the better. It's more fun being out riding motorbikes. And
just being out, being physical, whatever it is, getting some sun. I think it's better for everyone's mental health at the same time, really.
Absolutely.
You know, makes sense.
So how did you, I just want to always, I've always wondered, like, what goes through a Isle of Man TT rider's head? Like, You went over to... Did you go to Europe first? Did you go to the States first? What brought you over there?
Well, always wanted to race professionally. And, you know, the dream of MotoGP, I put that out of my head pretty early and realised it just wasn't really an option money-wise anyway. And was sort of looking at trying to get over to the States or maybe the UK. You know, World Superbikes is always where I wanted to ride. And then had the opportunity of racing professionally in Asia, Supersport, which is very competitive. And went over to the UK to do a couple of rounds of British Superbike for a privateer team, which had seen me race at Macau, the Street Grand Prix. So that was my introduction to street racing. And then when I went over there, went to the TT when I was racing BSB and had a look at it. Mm. And then it was just one of those things. And I guess growing up in Warrandyte, you know, from long before I had my learners, I was riding on the road. And I'd, you know, often Kangaroo Ground Road, King Lake Mountain, for those who don't, don't know, some amazing twisty scratching roads on sports bikes. So I just love riding on the road anyway, which is quite unusual for a racer. I mean, most of my teammates and racers I know don't even have their license.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of them don't,
eh? I've always ridden on the road and loved it. So to me, I guess, and when I saw the TT and just the road and the speed, it was something I had to do. It just really, really bit me when I went there. And I guess I'd already had the excitement of racing a real road at Macau, which is a street closed public road street race, but closed course, mass start, Armco rallying the whole way around. So it's very daunting. And I guess, I don't know, I mean, I wouldn't compare myself to like a free climber or a big wave surfer, or because to be honest, I think they're nuts. But it was sort of, there was a purity about not having that safety net, not having that runoff area. There was a real beauty about it. I guess the extra danger. It was just an opportunity for me to really push the envelope to a level that I'd never felt on the circuits. Does that make sense?
That's crazy.
That's a crazy way to look at it, eh?
That's why you're doing what you're doing and I'll do what I'm doing.
That's why I sell cars. Now, I need to know, going into Macau, that's your first race.
Yes.
That must have been extremely daunting. And am I right, you're with a Chinese team at the same time?
Yeah, so it was a Chinese team. So, and I rode a Yamaha. Went in there pretty blind. That was pretty much pre-YouTube kind of day. So, like, you know, I didn't see much of the course. I'd seen a VHS video and then turned up and, it was...
Can't even play the PlayStation game. No, like, seriously.
No. And, it was daunting to say the least, but I got a buzz out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that first turn at Macau, it's just... There's no runoff. It's just a fence. I mean,
very fast left-hand kink with about six rails of Armco on the outside.
Yeah, it's just crazy. I mean, I think... the Isle of Man course is the pinnacle and it's the craziest, but that's got to be close. It's scary, that place.
Well, having raced Macau a few times, I'll tell you, walking to the race, the start from he's normally staying in a high rise, kilometre or so away, and walking to the track in the morning. I mean, the feeling in my gut, the knots in my stomach at Macau are more intense than anywhere. There's something about being in at least the Isle of Man, you know, there's a bit of country, you see the ocean, but to be in China, having high-rise buildings, Armco, traffic, people everywhere, and a mass start. It's pretty intense.
I guess it's so foreign as well. It's just like a different language.
Yeah, you probably don't want to end up in hospital there either. No, like, as much as anything, just you don't know what anyone's saying. I mean, language barrier is a bit of an issue there, but there's something about it. It's very, very full on, that place.
What were you riding on then?
600 Supersport, Yamaha R6, I first went over there, they used to run Superbike and Supersport.
Yeah.
They ran both, and they ran them in a combined grid, and you just finished where you finished. So I think the first time I won Supersport, and I was 11th overall or something like that, but that's the way it ran. But they dropped Supersport out of it after a couple of years, and then it was just, which it is now, just Superbike.
Yeah. Geez, that's interesting, riding 600s and 1000s. Mm. Like, I guess you'd be passing 1000s on the inside and then getting blitzed on the straight.
It was a nightmare because the back of the track is very technical.
Yeah.
So the 600 was good. And I remember I raced Supersport there a couple of years, and I think another year, you know, we're up in the top 10 in Supersport, and it was a nightmare. Like, you're battling with trying to keep your competition away and getting, held up through the turns and then... But that's just, it's crazy enough as it is without doing that.
Yeah, it just seems like it adds another unnecessary dynamic to the race. You could just do two separate races. I mean, it would have been a bit more simpler, but Chinese, I suppose.
it's different. I mean, it's still going and it's going well.
I watched the race, though. I'm a big four-wheel fan.
Yes.
And watched the F3s go around there, and like, Oh, it's just, yeah, it's crazy. And that, like, the last corner, there's that huge, remember that
I was
huge accident?
There was a massive accident where, I think it was a Sheila racing. Yeah, wasn't it? She went flying through.
She lost the rear and then she went backwards into the barrier. And, like, on that, it was just crazy. And I couldn't imagine riding bikes around there.
No, it's got that hairpin that, I mean, well, that's right. Because the first time I was there when they bought an F1 car over. I can't remember whose it was. It was one from the back of the field at the time, and I think it was Eddie Jordan's team or something like that at the time. But they went out in the first lap. He didn't make that hairpin, was so tight, and touched the brake and shunted the wall. And they were only a couple of pit bays down from us and went there, and they were changing the under tray. They were saying, that was worth 20-odd thousand pounds at the time or something, just that piece. But I think the first flying lap, the test driver took, honestly, I think it was like 10 seconds off the outright F3 lap record on the first flying lap. Just gave you an indication of how fast F1 cars were, but it was still really wild to see an F1 car go around there.
Yeah, that's wild. That's really cool.
You also jumped in, did a bit of Northwest 200.
Yep, Northwest, another, I mean, it's arguably the biggest sporting event in Ireland as a whole. Huge event. Another one, like 5-6 miles, public roads. Yeah, really, really long straights. Like the straight there's, yeah, one of the longest straights. It's ridiculous, like a mile and a half long. You can slipstream someone, get slipstream back, slipstream them again before you're on the brake. So, yeah, talk about braking late. That's some really hairy, hairy moments around there. But, yeah, it's an interesting one, but it's always 2 weeks before the TT, so it's a tough one because as much as you want to push, and like 2007 with Centenary TT and I crashed there, and had a nasty collarbone break and had to miss the TT. So it's one of those ones where you want to, I mean, once you're there, you're racing, so you're not thinking about it, but you want to get out in one piece because you got the TT got 2 weeks later.
Yeah, that's right. What was it like coming back through that injury as well? Like you said, it was pretty gnarly.
Yeah, that was, it was just shit really because it cost me the TT and Centenary TT and my mum. She was coming over with some other family. My dad was coming over. None of them had ever been to the TT. I've never been since. And that was the 1 year they all came for the Centenary. My best mate came over that I grew up riding and racing with, and I ended up being on the hedge. In some ways it was good because I got to go around with my dad and we got to hang out and I got to take him to different vantage points and bars. And
That's nice.
And that
that's
was good. Really cool. But, it was a shame. But that's racing, you know. The injury itself was just a... it was a compound fracture of the collarbone. I remember it was it was laying there because the doctor slipped his hand inside my leathers. When he pulled it out, I saw there was blood in it, and I remember just thinking then, oh, that's not good. So he said, but that was that. And we went to, you know, you do like any racer, just played it. But as a surgeon said at the time, you know, you're going to race the TT, I'm not going to bolt it together. It's not going to hold together for that, no matter how tough you want to be or... pain you want to put up with, so I just had to let common sense prevail and sit back. But I did learn a lot watching for a year, actually, just seeing how riders worked and other teams. And from the outside looking in, you can learn a lot. And I tell that now when I see young riders like Nathan Harrison's an up-and-comer riding for Honda over there. And last year, you know, he got signed factory Honda for only second year at the TT and then got hurt. And I said to him, you know, he was obviously disappointed. But I said, you know, don't just get down about it. Make the most of the event. And walk around and watch how the other riders are working, look at them in their pit stops, look at them in all the different aspects you can. You can learn a lot from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely you can. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, 2008 was a bit of a turnaround and it actually worked in your favour.
Yeah, 2008 was great. I mean, that was first and had my wins, two wins, and I only ever got two wins, which only the TT, I mean, a lot of people try for a long time.
For sure.
It's a tough old race. Yeah, we won the Superbike race. We won the Superstock race. We're leading the senior. We had a mechanical failure with the bike, but we limped home in second, which was still great to get the overall win, the Joey Dunlop Trophy. So that was brilliant. I've led a couple of races convincingly and had mechanical issues. You know, I've led a race, had a convincing lead, and a race got stopped. You know, red flags, but that was because another rider lost their life. So you're sitting there thinking, poor me, and it sort of brings it back into perspective quite quickly. And we had a lot of, and a half a dozen second places, and it's just, it's just such a tough place. It's so hard on your body, it's so hard on the bike. So much has to go right to get a result there. And that's what makes, you know, what I've seen Michael Dunlop and Peter Hickman doing at the moment. I mean, the amount of wins those guys have got is really, really incredible, and just goes to show
They're unbelievable. You
know, how good they are going at the moment, yeah.
And just the mental fortitude to keep going as well with such a dangerous race.
Absolutely. And that's with myself, to be honest. I went there to do it once, and I promised my family I said, I just want to go and get a finishing medallion. And I did it, and of course, it just felt so good.
Yeah.
And to be honest, the first time I really thought, if I keep coming back here, I think I can win.
Yeah.
Straight away, I thought, if I apply myself to this, and all of a sudden, aspirations of World 2 bike and all this other short circuit stuff I was sort of on it trying to do really took back seat, because I just, there was nothing else like it. I was so focused on the TT, although I was still racing at British Championship, World Endurance, different, you know, very, very high level and professionally racing circuits. To me, it was really just a grounding for the TT. And then I went back, and then I got my win, and then I thought, once I won, I'll walk away. I always wanted to walk away sort of at the top of my game, if you like. But once it gets you, and then you go back and you have seconds, and then you change teams, and it's just, but I also knew that if I kept rolling the dice, it was going to bite me. So yeah. I did it 10 years, and I thought that's
enough.
Yeah, I did. And I've often talked about the last time I did it, I had a couple of catastrophic engine failures in practice week, and it was really that last one, a third breakdown, and you know, major rod through the front and the back of a Fireblade superbike engine at really high speed. And I just sort of sat there, you know, afterwards and just thought, I'm kind of done with this.
Mm.
That's fair enough.
I always have this conversation with the boys. I'm like, what just gets them back the next year? It must just, like you said before, it must just take you and just, you want to go back every year, and it's like Christmas.
You know, there's the law of diminishing returns. You do the same thing twice, you never get the same buzz.
Mm.
Whatever that is. They talk about it with, you know, people that take drugs, people that do lots of stuff to get a buzz. But I don't know. I haven't found that at the TT. Not that I've had probably compared it to any other extreme sports, because it's always been bikes for me. But, you know, short circuit racing's amazing, and I love it passionately, and I love doing it. It's very exciting. But there's something about the TT when you're out there just racing the clock. You're on your own. 67-kilometre course, 260 corners. So much can go wrong. There's so much you have to get right. That pressure on yourself as a rider, it's just... To me, it's so exciting, and the race changes depending on the conditions on your bike. Yeah, there's so much to me every time you go out. It is just, to be honest, it got better, it just got more exciting, and then it got worse, because 3 months before I was going overseas, I was already wound up like a spring, you know?
Because
I was only going there to do one thing, and that was win. I was never, ever going to go there to make up the numbers.
Yeah.
So that pressure you put on yourself, and you're quite prepared to die to win a race. And I say that now, and I think, I get chills, but I was at the time. No heroics. That was the job. So what were we talking about?
The passion.
That's what gets you back.
Yeah.
You can see it right there. And how you're talking right now.
Got a little bit scared, you know?
Yeah. Ready to punch a wall or something. It's so fired
up. That's the way you have to be.
Yeah.
That's the way you have to be.
Going back to mechanicals, I was actually going to ask you this. Every time I watch it, there's always mechanicals.
Yep.
And is it just because the bikes are just work so hard for so long that there's just always going to be failure? Because you watch short circuit racing, you don't see it that often, but it seems like this street racing, there's heaps and heaps of mechanicals.
Yep, it's just bumps and jumps. I mean, how far you jump them. I mean, people don't realise, you know, like Balacry, one of the jumps there, you're going up the road like 30 metres in distance because you're hitting it at 140, 50 miles an hour. So, you know, you might only be a couple of foot off the ground, but not to mention all the, not quite potholes, but there's some pretty big bumps. And I remember when I did the parade lap on the MotoGP bike, was celebrating Suzuki 50 years in Grand Prix. Mm. Their first Grand Prix was the Isle of Man. So did a parade lap in 2010 or whenever
the
it was.
The footage from that is incredible, by the way. It's incredible.
Kind of didn't wave to the crowd. I thought, got to ride a MotoGP bike, so I wasn't going to hang around. But a couple of things fell off. They said, did I just see a red light in the dash? And I did, but I said no, because I wasn't going to slow down, because I thought I don't want to stop. But one of the suspension potentiometers broken. There was a couple of other things came loose. So, you know, people asked me about that. How would a MotoGP bike go around the Isle of Man? I said, you'd smash a lap record on it, but you'd have to beef it up to finish. I remember seeing the thing. It was Caparossi's bike at the time on the bench. I think it was in his final year of GP or one of them. But even the suspension leakages are, you know, probably a third of the thickness of like a production bike. And just the bikes there have to be strong. When you look back in history, and I love the history of the TT, all the greats, you know, Agostini to even later years, Joey Dunlop and those guys, you know, it was sort of win, lose, or, you know, they were first, second, or they didn't finish because mechanically. Yep. And people now say, oh, the riders better now than they were back then. And I said, you can't really compare because from the start of the TT till now, someone won, someone lost, someone usually loses their lives. But back then they had to ride with mechanical sympathy, and now we don't really need that.
Yeah.
But yeah, stuff still breaks.
For sure. That's just so evident. You see it all the time. Going back to the Suzuki MotoGP, who approached you with that and what was it like riding that bike? Are they stiff, so much more stiffer compared to a production bike? Or
great question. So 50 years of Suzuki. Bruce Anstey had been riding for Suzuki longer than me.
Yeah.
So it was going to be Bruce, but Bruce is just such a man of mystery and he would often not answer the phone. Like once we went to Spain to pre-season test and he just didn't show up at the airport and didn't go to the test.
Yeah, right.
But then we went to the first race at the Northwest and the first race of the weekend, he finished second and I wasn't on the podium. So that's what you're up against. Like Bruce was a freak. He's a dear friend and I only just caught up with him at the TT this year. Haven't seen him for years. No wonder. He's just such a man of mystery. But anyway, I came to the point where they were like, we had to go to Silverstone and do some pre-TT. They did a PR thing. And they ended up getting me because I was just too worried about Bruce not showing up.
That's such a crazy thing.
Yeah, and it was a real shame because Bruce is just... But, you know, perfect example, just a quick story, Bruce Anstey. So we did the TT. I think it was 2008, so I had wins. Bruce, I think, won both Supersport races that year. So, like, you know, the guy is so fast. Mm. And after that, I did about 3-4 rounds of British Championship on the podium. Well, we had a lap record at Thruxton, I think. Like, I was doing some testing with the Superbike for the team and racing Superstock. We got to the Ulster Grand Prix, which is a street race no longer happening out of Belfast, in August. Bruce had not sat on a motorbike since the TT. Went out first practice session. I come in on the superbike. I said to my crew chief, where am I? He goes, oh, P2, 1.7 seconds down or something. You know, it's a long track. And I'm like, who's P1? And he goes, Bruce. And I turn around. Bruce is like taking his helmet off, yawning. And I'm just like, the guy's just a freak.
You know what? It doesn't kind of surprise me, though, that there's eccentric characters in that sport because you have to have a screw loose anyway.
Like Guy Martin's a great example.
Exactly right. You know, you can only understand one out of 20 words out of that guy.
And you need subtitles.
Yeah. Yep. But it really doesn't surprise me at the same time.
I always use, I'm too normal for this shit.
Yeah,
I think we're all, you know, most of us have just got the buzz and there'd be a lot more go out there and try it if they got the opportunity.
Yeah.
But it's... Yeah, there are some crazy characters in it, but Bruce Anstey is one of them. He goes under the radar because he was just so quiet and he was his own worst enemy in that sense. But when you got him on a motorbike, we would say if he got out of bed on the right side, see you later.
Yeah, untouchable.
Yeah. But so that was how we got on the Suzuki. And then it was they were worried about it had carbon brakes. They put the steel brakes. And I remember speaking to Loris and saying, because he said, I'll be careful with the brakes because they're not very good compared to the carbon.
Okay.
And I still remember the thing that stood out more than anything was the brakes. They were incredible. Probably the bulk of the bikes, it's so light.
Yeah.
That was an 800, but still how hard it revved. I think it was near 17,000 RPM.
Yeah, wow.
And just the power, just the weight accelerator. And I was on a, you know, a super bike, I guess you could say a factory, some sort, a lot of Suzuki stuff. Factory stuff, big horsepower super bike. It was mind-blowing, but it was actually really compliant. The chassis worked really well.
Yeah,
we actually learned a lot about the superbike that year.
Yeah, right.
Because I said, this thing's easier to ride than my superbike.
I wouldn't have thought that.
No, but Suzuki, in 2009, they bought that new model out and they really went the wrong way with a lot of development.
Yeah, I've heard you speak about that, actually.
Yeah, up to like 7.8 was like amazing. We're talking the thousands, right?
I've still got a K8, the best. Yeah. That's what I want
So those up until then, and you're right, 2009, they sort of revamped it all in it.
Just didn't work.
Just a bit of a lull for Suzuki for a little bit.
And to be honest, I mean, everyone's got a sob story, but, you know, I won in 08, 09, we came back and we had the new bikes. And at the Northwest, we'd gone from winning everywhere to we're nowhere, but self and Bruce making up the numbers, just couldn't get the bike to work. And it was at the TT during practice week that the boss of the team, well, his dad, started Taz Racing. They're that Cheshire Mouldings BMW team this year, right? Davey Todd. Winning everything and running Rory Skinner, ex-Moto2, who just had his first BSB win at Knockhill last week. So his dad said, the K8's in the truck, get it out, put the boy on the K8. And like Philip's like, we're factory Suzuki, we can't ride the old bike. And he's like, well, you tell the Japs that we can win on a Suzuki or we'll finish nowhere, put him out on the bike, at least get him to do a lap and he can come in and give us some direction where we've gone wrong with the 09 because my head was completely cooked. And I went out in the 2008 at the TT in practice 2009. Just as I was leaving the pit, my crew chief said, it's got a full tank, if it feels good, do two laps. And I was like, sweet. And I went out, and from the standing start, we virtually equaled the current, at the time, record. Yep. And then my second lap was the first ever over 131 mile an hour lap ever. And I came in and I was like, I'm not even trying. Like, I was in the zone. Like, yeah, I was, but I was just like,
flow state.
And that's when I was like, tell them whatever, we're just going to win. And then the next night, we'd agree that I'd ride the 2009 stock bike. And that's where I ran wide in that corner, missing a gear, went onto the grass, crashed, dislocated my shoulder. But I firmly believe to this day, if we'd stayed on the 08, we could have kept winning. You look at McGuinness, one of the reasons that Honda, he kept winning. I mean, John's exceptionally good, but that fire blade didn't change for so many years.
Yeah.
And some years you get a wet practice week, or people, the BMW came, they're trying to develop a new bike. John was on the pace from the first night of practice every year for year.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So the TT, you only get one bite every year. So, you know, and you can get the new BMW when it came out. Everyone's like, it's fast, it's going to do this, going to do that. Went to the TT and did nothing because it took a couple of years to get it.
Well, that makes sense. And I guess as well, like, you got to have big balls anyway, and you're going to have trust in your machinery underneath you. And if you've ridden that same similar bike for 6 years or 5 years, you're going to have a lot more trust.
You know what it's going to do. It's all about confidence. Yeah. It's all about confidence.
What do you think about that RC213V MotoGP bike I've seen roll around Isle of Man? How does that go?
Bruce, I mean, Michael Rudd has raced it for years, backed by Batham's Brewery, and it's been a fantastic, just for the crowd.
Sounds gross.
Yeah, but Bruce rode it at, he's had a ride on one and did very well. I think he podiumed in the senior in it, because you could race it in the senior technically.
Excuse
me, I think something like that would be epic. It's just whether you got the money to run it.
Yeah,
because I was talking to the guys, Batham's, even every time they worked it out, like, I don't know how much it is, but it's many $1,000 a lap.
Yeah,
I think the crankcases are only 800 miles or something before you change crankcase. Not even that, 500 miles. Like, it's
really... You're not getting much out of them.
No. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy. But if one of the manufacturers wanted to bring one, it'd be epic. And it would be, it'd be really cool to see. And they could.
Yeah, they could. They definitely could. Tell us more about when you were at the Isle of Man this year. And I don't know if we can talk about this and we can edit it out if we can't, but they were doing a Netflix Drive to Survive type of series.
Well, that's the talk at the moment, is that the same production company, the one's partly owned by Brad Pitt, and I don't know who else, but they've been at the TT doing a lot of work, and the word is, don't know if it's confirmed or what level it's at now, but the talk is that there will be basically similar to Drive to Survive and F1 on the TT, which would be a brilliant thing to get behind the scenes.
Sure.
And TT, with their own content, are doing a lot of that now anyway.
Yeah.
But they're probably preaching to the converted a little bit, where something like that, to take it to the masses. I mean, so many people around the world wouldn't believe it still happened.
Well, that's right. And I think it would work, and we were talking about this just before, about the personalities, and then the personalities of those riders are insane. And I don't think it'd be hard to get people on the hook with that. It's already an amazing product, but then the personalities is just the cherry on top, isn't it?
You know, bikes have always been working. Bike races, riders. You know, my grandfather rode, when my dad grew up, their family transport was a motorbike and sidecar. That's all they had. And it wasn't because it was cool, it was because it's all he could afford. Bikes have always been working class. I see it now, even when I've gone and ridden at, Festival of Speed at Goodwood. You know, you're there and you're the car people, the bike people, it's, you know, the bike people that are there are wealthy. The car, it's like vulgar wealth. You know, like it's just, and the same when I've been lucky enough to race at the Revival, you know, I've been lucky enough to ride some really special bikes. But some of these car guys that own cars and stuff there, it's just so, and I think, still, bike people are still a little bit more down to earth in some ways. Nothing against car people. So, and especially, you know, because there's not a lot of money in it, in the TT. You're there because you love it.
Yeah.
And even if you weren't, even if first prize is $1 million, once you head off down Bray Hill with a visor down, that's money doesn't come in your head. You know, I don't think anything could make you hold that throttle open.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Maybe
for sure.
You go through one corner faster because there was $1 million on the other side, but to keep it together for a race that's an hour and a half long, nearly an hour and 45 minutes, you know, on a superbike averaging over 200 kilometres an hour average, you know, for one hour 45.
It's unbelievable, so, isn't it? It's a long time to concentrate, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
Like, just to be on it for that long, I mean, that's pinnacle, I think, of motorsport right there.
Your head feels like a marshmallow. Like, when you've done the 2 weeks, physically, you're beat up, you're destroyed, like, your chest is bruised, your neck, because you spend so much time with your head above the screen at high speed, just because of the nature of the track and trying to look ahead, and because you're wrestling the bloody thing half the time around there anyway. And then that level of concentration, people always say, how do you concentrate? How do you not make mistakes? And I always say the same thing, because you can't.
Without being funny about it.
You will. There's not an option of making a mistake, you know. And I guess it's like, I'm fascinated by some of those movies recently with those guys doing those free climbing. There's been a few epic ones.
Yeah.
Just, oh, man, they get you in, the emotion, the intensity. But I get it.
Yeah.
Although, you know, no way. But I understand why they want to just test themselves to that point. And too, you know, Australia, there was a time when we were young and free and loose and wild, and now we're just so wrapped in cotton wool that even more so now to think that the TT still goes on. It's just, for how long, I don't know. It seems to be going from strength to strength.
Yeah,
it's just so good in this day and age where we're so bloody protected from ourselves.
Yeah, it's
just awesome.
Can
you tell I'm passionate about it?
Absolutely. I love it. It's so good.
You're not getting a word in voice.
No, that's
trust me, people don't want to listen to us in this podcast. Exactly right.
How long does it take to learn the track? How many years?
When I went there, they said it's a three-year apprenticeship. 1 year to work out which way it goes, second year to build speed, and a third year to even think about getting a result.
Yeah.
I'd agree with that. We've had some exceptional riders there, like Glenn Irwin, that's been British Superbike champion. Just missed out on another championship last year, carrying the number two plate on the PBR racing Ducati at the moment. Yeah, he went there as a newcomer with a factory Honda, first time, and he did over 130 mile an hour, you know, and his first time there was incredible.
Oh, wow.
But he didn't go back. Which, and I've spoken to him, and he's a hell of a nice guy, and he wears his heart on his sleeve. He's very, I'll never forget, he said, "I love the TT, I love my family more. I've got young kids, it's just not for me, but it might be later." And I was like, "Phew." And I was like, "Did you have any moments?" He was like, "A few, enough to realise that it was, and I mean, that's a rider at an elite level, but there's been other riders at very high level go on there and just, you know, I've seen people leave at the end of practice.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, right.
You know, it's just say it's not for me.
That's full on, isn't it?
So, yeah, I'm sure, you know, people often said, you know, Rossi's coming down a parade lap and, you know, how do you think he'd go if he wanted to race here? And when he was in his prime, if he wanted to do it, he'd probably smoke everyone, but you got to want to do it. But, yeah, back to the question, I think a couple of years. When I look back, the second year I raced there, which was my first year on a superbike, I went there in 600 only, came back in 06 and rode an ex-Team Honda superbike, which is a real good bike, and I finished second in the senior that year to John. I actually broke the lap record mid-race. He broke it again to beat me. But when I look back, I think that's probably my proudest ever result at the TT, more so than my wins second year, because I was – you know, taking a lot of chances and I was still so new to it.
Yeah.
But you never stop learning, you know. You think you know it and then you pass a rider in a section because you've never been on that bit of road and you'll hit a bump or you'll find out there's no grip. Like, you know, it's such a big course. You never stop learning. And that's the thing, you've got to – it takes time to do your apprenticeship, you know, and then in perfect conditions, but then when it's wet, you know where it holds dampness. When it's sunny, you know where it gets you, sun glare.
Yes.
When it's windy, you know what corners it –
yeah, where it's come through.
You want to hear it? You can edit this out, so I'll tell you this story because this is one
I've told many people. Keep talking.
So this is the kind of thing you're up against. Can't remember the year. It's a wet supersport race. They started us really damp patches. I don't think they'll start a race again like that.
Okay.
I think there have been several delays, so they're under pressure to get it racing. Sitting up in the start line, 67 kilometres a lap, four laps, no siding lap, no warm-up lap.
That's wild to me. You don't know what are you heading yourself into.
And that's the other, you know,
crazy.
You do a track day, you do a lap or two just to
warm up, get a feel for it.
Even you're racing a club race, you know, you're Preston, Hartwell Club, whatever, you're down at Phillip Island, you get a 10-minute warm up Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Then you get your mind into it.
You get a siding lap to go around the grid. Yeah,
that's right.
TT, you know, 200 and whatever plus at the tyre horsepower, shiny tyres, full tank brimmed to the neck. They wheel it up on the start line when it's in the sunshine. The fuel starts coming out the overflow into the belly pan. You know, you're standing there, you've got out of bed a couple of hours ago. The fastest you've been is maybe 30 miles an hour in the car coming to the unless you're staying like most of the riders in caravans or motorhomes at the track. So you haven't even been anywhere. Maybe your mountain bike or your scooter to the pits. And when the starter, you roll up in single file, 10 seconds apart, the last five bikes to the start line, then you move through what they call no man's land. So your mechanics, no one goes through that gate, and just five bikes, then four, then three, then two, then you. You go up, the starter's got his hand on your shoulder, the little starter down the start line there, he waves a little Union Jack every 10 seconds, lets go of your shoulder, take off, and within, yeah, at the bottom of the Bray Hill, within 20 seconds, you're doing like 180 miles an hour.
Just so, no warm-up, nothing.
The no-sighting lap is crazy. Yep. Like, you don't know what you're getting. You don't know if there's a branch on the road. You don't know any, like...
So then we're going out in this wet super sport race or damp, and they've got water and Caramore, damp patches at, you know, Governor's Dip, like all names, because it might be corner 147, corner 209, like, you know, and it's just like, I can't even remember where half these places are. Like, I know the track intimately, but I don't know the names. So you're just like, okay, and you go out there, and if you want to win, you can't hang around. And actually, Michael and William Dunlop then were just gone out on their own. But I was in on road with Keith Moore and John McGuinness. There was three of us really close on road, and we came through this Union Mills on the first laps about 3 miles in, and there was a lack of adhesion flags up, and there was quite some damp patches. Anyway, came through lap two, come through, same flags. There'd been another shower of rain, so the track was like triple as wet. And Keith Moore, when I came through, had a massive moment. I looked over my shoulder, and the guys were gone, and I was like, oh. So Keith Moore had crashed. Lucky he'd lost it, and he'd gone up the middle of the road himself, so he was unhurt. About 5 minutes later, the whole race got red flagged. Yeah. So they stopped the race at marshal points and stop all the riders around the track to neutralise the course. So I pull in, McGuinness pulls in, and I'm like, where were you? And he goes, oh, I came through. And I said, did you? What? He said, oh, Keith crashed, but he was already on his feet when I went through. So what happened to you? He said, oh, I just rolled off before Union Mills. And I'm like, what, just before we hit that damn patch? He said, yeah. I said, why? And he goes, oh, when you go through that valley there, they grow garlic near there, and just after when it's just rain, the garlic always smells really strong, and I thought it was stronger on the second lap than the first, so I rolled it. And to this day I'm like, nah,
that's fucked,
like,
up.
And I'm just looking him in the eye, and I'm like, John, nah, you shit him. And he's like, I rolled off, didn't I? And I'm just like, wow. Like, without being rude, I mean, you know, I think someone could take a turd on my fuel tank and I wouldn't smell it racing around the TT. Like, I'm that in the zone. And then he's telling me he smelt garlic, so he's rolled off the throttle. And I'm like, how are you meant to beat that? Like,
that's wild.
So that's,
man,
the kind, and to this day, I still don't know. But all I know is this, well, he did roll off, didn't he? You know, and there's.
That's experience. Like, so that's, you to the utmost.
And that's what I tell now. Get to work with some younger riders at the TT. I always try to pass on as much knowledge as I can. That's one thing about TT riders, will pass on.
Yeah.
There's a camaraderie, you know. Quite often we'll be on the start line before you head out, you know. You look each other in the eyes, you say, I'll see you in four laps, I'll see you in six laps. Like, you don't get that in the circuits.
Nah, for sure.
Oh, no way.
Because everyone knows what's on the line. But, yes, so that's what you're up against with learning.
Jeez.
And now the young guys coming up against Dunlop and Hickman and Dean Harrison, you know, the young guy, there's some really fast riders coming through, but not only have they got to ride as fast, they've got to gain that knowledge. It takes time.
Absolutely. Yeah. This might be a silly question. The guys that come from track and then go do that, do you think they have to adapt their riding style, or did you ever have to adapt your riding style?
Yeah, definitely. You ride differently, sort of the same but different. I don't know, maybe you could compare it to motocross or supercross.
Yep.
You know, you'll get guys that are really at the same, well, it's the same, isn't it? It's dirt and there's jumps. Well, yeah, but no. So, you know, I mean, look at, I don't know, look at Chad Reed, you know, epic supercross, AMA motocross, he probably wasn't as dominant.
Yep.
Or he wasn't, but that's probably because his focus was on that, but it's the same, but different. And that's, and there's times, you know, I mean, Pete Hickman's was winning races in British Championship. He's having not a great run at the moment. Neither's Brooksy, but we know what those guys are capable of. It's not to say one's better or worse. I just think it's where your focus is. But definitely at the end of the day, I think the more short circuit racing you can do at that high level, at the end of the day, you know, you're sliding a motorbike on two tyres, you're locking the front brake, you're there's nothing that makes up for that time. I see Michael Dunlop this year, you know, he did Le Mans. You know, there's a good reason for that. That's massive time in the saddle doing the 24-hour endurance race. So you want to be, you know, they all do different racing, but it's all about, it's a little bit like Tour de France, you know. They all off doing different races and stuff, but really, at the end of the day, it's just trying to put the piece of the puzzle together for that one event.
One event.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I didn't realise Michael Dunlop did Le Mans 24-hour.
Yeah, he did it this year. Yeah, they finished. I rode for a privateer Superstock Honda team. They did all right. They're a good team. Can't they did weren't in the box. I think they were fifth in Superstock or something like that.
It was top five, wasn't it?
Okay, yeah, it was good. But it's good, but it's, you know, it's a bit like TT. There's a lot can go wrong in a
world
endurance race too.
And you've done a little bit of that, haven't you?
Did a couple of years with the Honda. They did a TT Legends team, so did a couple of years, a year as a reserve and a couple of years racing. So I got to do Le Mans and Bol d'Or, which are races I'd always wanted to do. So the 24s are really, epic. And just the crowd, like Le Mans, lucky enough to do the Le Mans start at Le Mans.
Wow.
And like, wow, man, like that is a big crowd, like
what
way over 100,000. Maybe 13, 12, 13, 14, So, a while ago now, time passes, but... that was really cool actually, because the Honda got incredible fuel economy, as Hondas always do. They're just so good. Like, we could do another two laps in any other team in World Endurance at the time. Right. It was factory backed effort. So I think I was running fifth before people were pulling into the pits. So I was leading, was cool, the pits before the pit stop, which was really cool. I think we ended up fourth, fifth at that. Yeah, we were in top five in a couple of 24s.
Nice.
So we did well, but yeah, the starts. Anyway, I got told I'm going to do the start, and I'm told keep out of the way, you know, the French riders will get. And I'll never forget who hole shot the race in that race was actually Loris Baz.
Yeah, really.
And he freaking lap two, high-sided out of the lead. I'll never forget watching him skid off thinking.
Typical Loris Baz.
And I'm like, it's 24 hours, man. Like, and the team boss had drilled into me, the French, they're all going to crash. They're all going to just keep out of the trouble, keep out of trouble.
French,
and he was so
French.
Right. French in front of, you know, like way over 100,000. You know, the crowd at Le Mans makes MotoGP look like a club day. Le Mans 24 hour.
It's
so big. It's like a European Bathurst. It's just full of French bogans. It's insane. You go walking around the paddock, it's terrifying, like some of the stuff.
We've heard it's a pretty serious party down there.
Yeah, at Bathurst.
At Le Mans. Le Mans.
Yeah,
we did a pod with Damien Cullen. And he was talking about, like, I think his engine blew on the third lap or something, and he went into the middle of the track and just partied.
Got on the beers.
I was a reserve 1 year, so I didn't race. I didn't, you know, I was there to do the qualifying practice sessions as the fourth rider. But once, you know, pre-race, they nominate their rider. So I walked out to the outfield. That was at Bol d'Or, and even that was just the year I was at Le Mans, like, man, that 1 year I was there, two people died. One fell out of the grandstand in a pit lane during the race. Yeah, from above the pits into pit lane. My missus came out, there was all commotion, and when I came in from a pit stop, she's like, I think someone died. And I'm like, what? She said someone fell into pit lane out of the grandstand above the pits. And then someone else out in the outfield, because they have power points for it. So there's like 20 double adapters on 20 power boards. And some drunk French guy took a piss on the power boards as a joke in front of his mates and got electrocuted.
Oh, through the dick.
Yeah.
So what a way to go. At Le Mans. At the 24 hours.
Yeah, it's actually not a bad way to go, to be honest.
But I'll never forget. So I'm on so we're like fifth in qualifying or something. So I'm at the front of the group ready for Le Mans start. Of course, you run to your bike. That's the whole thing why it's called Le Mans start. Your crew chief's holding the fire blade there. And then the French guy in the middle of the track starts doing the countdown from 10 backwards. No shit, that's the first time I'm like, huh, I don't speak French.
Yeah,
like, seriously, I'm just standing there going, oh my God. It was like a nightmare. Yeah. And then I'm just like looking at the guys next to me, waiting for them to twitch. And of course, you know, he lifts the French flag, runs towards you, you run to the bike. But it's so awesome. Like, all you can hear is your heart in your head, you know, beating, and your legs feel like you're wearing concrete boots.
Yeah.
So are you on this pit lane and the bikes are on the other side? Or
bikes are against pit wall on pit lane.
And then you're running
standing
from the
in front
side.
Of the grandstand.
Gotcha.
And the crowd, like, they just get them in a fever pitch. Like,
so
you still
you still qualify.
Yep.
And if you're first, your bike's up the front.
Correct.
Yeah, gotcha.
So I think, I don't know how many 60 starters or whatever, and it goes down. But, yeah, as far as motorsport, just epic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in the obviously the Le Mans 24-hour cars, bikes. It's amazing. Yeah. Got to get there 1 year. We have to do it.
You too.
It's just incredible.
We have to do it 1 year because it's just Yeah, I mean, we don't get that endurance here as much.
It's a shame we did. We had, you know, Bathurst and, I mean, we had a whole endurance series here. We, you know, Winton and Calder. It was a 6-hour, I think, at Calder, and it was quite big. But, yeah, it's a shame because it's great racing, but it needs to be very much production-based to make it affordable.
Yeah, that's it. It's very true. I remember Damo Cullen talking about when he was riding through, it was like a 2 a.m., 3 a.m. stint, and all he could, like, he was just trying to smell for oil because I knew that someone blew the bike up, and he was just trying to smell for oil.
Not garlic.
not garlic. And or you could just smell everyone's sausages, just all the smoke going over, and it would burn his eyes.
Yeah, it was wild.
Oh, and your clothes, and because it smelled like smoke, because they get tyres, and they burnt tyres in the outfield. It's just this thick smell of burning rubber, haze. It really is like going to war. It's such a crazy... It is a trip. I remember one year I did, we did myself and John McGuinness. Keith Amore had a shoulder injury and he started the race. And with Honda, then you got paid when you raced. And so he said he was okay. And like in the first stint, within 20 minutes, his times were dropping off. So myself and John basically rode back to back for the rest of the race for the 24. That, and that was, it was like a trip. It was such a surreal.
Sleep deprivation. How's that?
Yeah, it's extreme. And, you know, people, it's a fact that I often quote to people is, you know, people talk about food and water. You'll die through lack of sleep before you will through lack of food or water. Mm. So that's how important sleep is. Yeah. It's the most important, basic, fundamental thing. It only takes a matter of hours before your judgment and your action time starts slipping measurably by percentages. So it's not natural. And 24 hours starts at 3 p.m.
Yeah.
So, you know, at 5 o'clock you wake up because you need a pee and then you're like, oh, I'm starting the 24 hour, you know, or I'm in the race. So you're not going back to sleep unless you're Bruce Anstey. So you're just like, you're toey already. Then you go, then you do a 1 hour warm up between three riders and then they do open pit lane for like an hour and 90 minutes. So you got French Bogans in cut off denim shorts wanting you to sign their posters and just, it's so wacky, but it's, and then you get your leathers on, then you start. So you're pretty knackered by the time you start. Then it doesn't finish till 3 o'clock the next day. So, I know Kaz said a couple of times the nights after in bed, I'm, you know, waking up, yelling, kicking around because I've lost the front in a high speed turn.
Or, oh, you're having nightmares and stuff.
Yeah, big
about
time.
It. That's crazy. Yeah,
absolutely tripping balls.
Yeah, that's interesting. I bet you're, I bet your wife's happy that you don't race TT anymore. Is that a conversation you had with her or is it a.
She pretty much, of course. I mean, she rode women's motocross. She rode, you know, off her own bat. She started riding because she loved it. She worked in the bike industry, you know, for a few years selling bikes, and she still rides bikes. She tests bikes for bike sales, and she's passionate and she gets it, which I think helps.
I think that's
why
a big
we're
difference.
Together.
Yeah.
So she knows why I was doing it. But, I mean, you know, I was the one that wanted to start a family without getting too deep. And I remember someone, and she's like, I'm not ready for kids. And I'm like, and I remember once she said to me, why do you want to start a family so bad? And I said, because it'll stop me racing the TT.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, I need to do something to stop because, you know. Mm. But
oh, it's just amazing. It's amazing. Like, I remember watching, we were speaking this before the pod, watching that movie, Closer to the Edge, TT, and just seeing the families and the wives sitting there watching on TV and the accidents and the death. I just don't know how you deal with that. You know, if someone dies on the track and then you're red flag and then you've got to come out the next day or the next couple of days and race. I mean, I just don't know how that mentally you can do it.
Yeah, I guess.
Because it can happen to anyone.
It can, but it won't happen to you. When you're racing, it won't.
That's
it won't happen to me. I mean, I saw it happen from the first time I went there. I'll never forget. There was a newcomer and there was a guy, Jakob Carlson, who was Euro guy, fast. We were both newcomers at the Northwest. We sat in the bus together, at the newcomers bus, and went to all the briefings together. We were getting along really well. And then I think second night of practice at the TT, he crashed and got killed. And I was just like, I remember saying to my mechanics, like, are they going to stop the event? He goes, nah, mate, they just go on. Like, tomorrow people will be a bit down and next day people will... the next day and then you'll just forget it even happened. And sadly, it'll only be his family that are dealing with it for a long time. And you sort of, everyone just blanks it out and says, you know, he died doing what he loved, and which is probably true. But since I've stopped writing, I love doing a lot of things, but I don't want to die making love either.
Yeah, that's true. Not a bad way to go, though.
Barely get electrocuted through your dick.
But, you know, but the thing is, at the end of the day, if you if there wasn't a risk of dying, it wouldn't be as exciting.
Yeah, that's it.
The danger makes the excitement.
Yeah.
So, but what you put your family through is... It's cruel, and we're selfish, and we're racers, and we're men, and well, you know, it's women race too. But of course, we are. It's a selfish pursuit, very selfish.
You look at like Michael Dunlop. I mean, he's 26 wins. Is it? He's broken the record. I mean, how does he come back next year and go, I want to keep going. I want to do it again. Like, there's got to be a point in time where you've been there, done that. Obviously, he's had family history of at the TT for so long. I mean, and he's seen tragedy over the years.
Yeah, I just don't know. You know, I mean, I was teammates with his brother William. Before he lost his life racing, and it was a mechanical fault that caused that crash. I mean, his dad, Robert, died. I mean, I was there racing that so many at the Northwest. I mean, Michael went out and won the race the day after.
I remember that.
And if you ever want to look up an intense bit of motorsport, no, a beautiful piece of motorsport, look up that race. That next day, that 250 GP race, that was, and he wasn't given it. It was a really top English rider he was up against, and he won that race, and his dad died 2 days earlier. Like, it was just...
That's intense.
I've seen the footage of that. That's insane.
That post-race is just... It is worth watching. It's better than any movie, like, because it's real. And that's what they do, you know? And, of course, their uncle Joey, the late great Joey, there's so many. Basically, they just race, they die.
Yeah.
With all due respect, it's...
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Like, I spoke to Michael. You know, we've had our differences... You know, we had a punch on many years ago and we didn't see eye to eye for some time. Now we seem to have, there's a mutual respect. And, you know, that's all water under the bridge. But, and I spoke to him at the TT this year, he said a couple of times, I won't be doing this for forever. You know, I've got other things to do. And that's another reason with manufacturers, like this year's Supersport, he bought a Triumph and a Yamaha, his own bikes. What other level of motorsport could someone do that? Bring two different brands and go, I'm going to use what works. Because I don't give a shit about that brand and I don't care. I just want to win.
Yeah.
And that's a tool for the job and I don't have to keep anyone happy. Cause he said, 10 years' time, I'll be doing something else and they won't care who I am, blah, blah, blah. Just probably a bit short-sighted because I'm sure any brand would hang on to him forever as an ambassador, but it's not the way he works. Mm. And I do admire that, the way he does his own thing.
Mm.
But, if you keep going, sooner or later, unfortunately, you think something's got to...
Well, percentage-wise, I mean...
Yeah, you know. It's one of those things that you just... Mm. But I don't know, but then... Same with Rossi. Oh, he should have retired earlier. He should have, you know... As long as the competitor's enjoying it and they're doing That's it... The at the end of the day, they're doing it for them.
Like you said, it's selfish and they're trying to get that buzz.
He's not married. He doesn't have kids, you know.
It's
a way of making a living. James Hillier is a really good friend. He's very successful at the TT and he rode Dakar the other year. He's a pretty amazing character. He's got three young kids and he's really tight with his family. And I spoke to him openly about it. It's probably a personal thing to repeat, but how do you manage with a kid? And he said it's really, really tough. But he said also, you know, financially too, I love it. And it gives me an opportunity after the TT, you know, we might go to Europe or go away for 6 weeks with the kids and do stuff that I could never do if I wasn't doing this. So, you know, there's positives to it as well.
Yeah, we always forget, and talking to people over the last year with podcasting and stuff, money's still a big, like, factor.
Got to pay the bills.
Got to pay the bills. Yeah. And, like, you looked at these moves in MotoGP and Formula One vehicles because moves you see over the years, you go, oh, why do they do that? Why is Quartararo stayed at Yamaha? Why is this? Why is that? He's getting paid $12 million a year, you know? Like, he can set his family up for life, you know? It's a big difference. So, but that's the rawness of the TT riders is the money isn't huge. You're doing it for the love, you know?
Absolutely. But at the end of the day, when you're in the midst of it, you've still got to pay the bills. So.
That's it.
And a lot of the guys don't have a lot to fall back on. You know, it's what they do, you know. When I say that, I'm sure all of them, the way I always put it too, your work ethic, if you can use some of the discipline and the commitment that you use for racing in anything in life, you're going to go good.
Yeah.
A lot of riders don't realise that. People in motorsport, full stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you doing with yourself now, Cam? I heard a bit of concrete expertise. Yep.
Concreting, so...
That's good.
I'm originally a plumber and work family at garden supplies and driving trucks and just any job that I could fit in between racing. But then, I've been on the tools concreting now sort of 6 or 8 years and I still bike test and coach and do plenty of other cool stuff. But, concrete, I love it. Really awesome. Like it. Yeah, it's fun. It's hard work. I like being. We talk about being outside. It's good for the soul and keeps you fit. And there's not bad money in it, so it's all right.
All around Melbourne doing it, or is that your way?
Just out our way. I used to do commercial, now I just do more domestic and stuff close to home. So I can, you know, try to pick my kids up from school once a week, and I try to get to the motocross track once a week lately, and stuff like that. That if I, it'd be very hard to do work for someone else. So
yeah, absolutely.
I'm pretty blessed. I work really hard at it. I love concreting. It goes off. It's exciting. Yeah. Like, you've got a taunt. It doesn't wait for anyone. So it's not quite as exciting as racing bikes, there's a lot can go wrong. And I love that.
And you're looking at the sky a lot as well.
All the weather. All the time.
I got my I should have called you, but I got my driveway done, and it was a bit hot. It was like two degrees hotter than it should have been. And the guy was cursing and crying.
I deal with that.
I had to add a bit more water to it.
So anyone listening, if you want a concrete job, give us that. To be honest, at the moment, I've dropped next Monday just down the road here in Greensboro as someone that used to race. Like, it's just the amount of work through bikes is ridiculous, which is cool because bike people are good people.
They want to look after each other.
It's
such a tight community.
It is. It's huge.
You mean following the local series?
A little bit. I do. Yeah. I mean, there's a big gap between races at the moment. So, but I do. And that's another thing I still feel quite passionately about. And I think it'd be good if we brought it back to like just super stock thousands and made it affordable. So maybe.
Yeah, I think that's where it needs to go.
Or a summer series. And now, interesting, because I was talking to Half Beltram, he's the manager of Honda UK. And like he was saying with BSB, he goes, has to go to like super stock. So the manufacturers, we can't afford it. And when you look at, I mean, okay, let's look at the Isle of Man. The outright lap records, 136.3. And that was Peter Hickman on a superstock bike. It's the outright record.
Mm. That was last year's TT?
Yep.
Yeah.
Wasn't even on the superbike.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that was nuts. Everyone was going mental.
Yeah. And as he was saying, British supers, like for the money, because we do a thing for the show this year, there's a superbike, £120,000, whatever, there's a stock bike, £20,000. You know, like, it's just they need to bring it back to, well, 25,000, 30,000, whatever, you know, your SPs and pretty trick stuff, but bring it back to, you know, fork, internals, shock, brake lines. That's really, and the racing would be just as good.
Yeah, you're not going to notice it. We always talk about this. You're not going to notice the difference. Like, no one really cares if there's 2 seconds a lap different as a spectator.
And it wouldn't even be a second.
Yeah.
At British Superstock, I mean, okay, Davey Todd the other day qualified pole, he would have been P8 in Superbike. And he's running a treaded tyre in there. So just the treaded tyre slick is probably another few tenths.
Yeah.
So
they need to do it. And then for Aussies, I would think all of a sudden you'd have, you know, 30, 35 bikes in the grid instead of 20, 25. And that's more of a spectacle.
For sure.
Definitely. Yeah, there's too much of a gap between the races, like you said, and it's becoming a lot harder for people to get into it. But it seems to be the way that it's going to move forward with super bikes and the change of GP.
Yep.
In the capacity there, they're saying that might now come down to more of a like world superstock.
Yeah. Well, I think it needs to. You know, motorsport is always going to be expensive, but it needs to be. Yeah, I think it's. There's no negative in my opinion.
No, absolutely. And you're saying you're doing a bit of coaching and stuff as well. Where are you doing that out of?
Just here and there. I used to coach quite a bit of adventure stuff for BMW. Do some stuff for Triumph, other manufacturers. And some one-on-one stuff at track days and bits and pieces here and there, just always doing something to keep the eye in as well, and still a lot of bike testing, which is really, really cool, just to ride the latest and greatest stuff and see what's going on, which is good. Heading up in 2 weeks, I think, to Gold Coast for new Indian launch, their new Scout range, stuff like that. You know, I mean, it's a dream job, isn't it?
Yeah, that's cool.
So it's pretty cool to get to see what's going on, because I ride road and I ride all disciplines, so it's good just to see what's going on.
Tell me about this 24-hour crazy motocross thing you're doing.
So it's the South Australian 24-hour trial. Amazing, it's the longest running motorcycle race in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, right.
So this year is the centenary. It's 100 years. So my dad and my pop used to talk about it. They knew of it back in the day. So it's a 24-hour trial. It's north of the Barossa up Kapunda or Yadunda in South Australia, sort of middle of nowhere unless you're from out that way. It's a really old school enduro format. So you have a minute. You start off on your minute and you ride a transit section. So you're allocated a time to do your transit. You pull up to the competitive. When your minute comes up, you do your competitive. So, you know, I looked the other day, the first transit might only be a few kilometres to a private property, and then the first competitive might be, say, 6 kilometres of technical dry creek bed, a few logs, whatever, a bit of a paddock. And then you go back to a transit and then a competitive. Some of the transits are 20-odd k. Some of the competitives are, you know, 15 kilometres long too. But it basically takes you 6 hours if you're running on time to complete a lap.
Wow.
And you do 4 laps in a row. No outside assistance at all.
No way.
So well, you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah.
No way.
And your own gear, your own spares. There's 3 pit stops per lap. When I say pit stops, they're an area where you're allowed a box of food and drink, and you're allowed a jerry can of fuel, and you're allowed unlimited air cleaners, everything else. And your boxes are numbered, so they go through the boxes. So if you've got a clutch lever or a jacket or a pair of gloves, you're disqualified straight away. So there's no outside assistance. So it's quite hard to keep to time. So I've done it 3 years, and yeah, I don't know why I'm doing it again. It's so bloody hard. But I want to be part of the centenary and have a crack at the vets class. Really, you worry about just trying to finish, and wherever you finish is a bonus. But it's brutal. It takes you to some pretty dark places at times, you know. But it's, yeah, so we're doing that to head off next week. So that's why I've been riding a bit of motocross lately, just to get a bit of grit.
24 hours, no team, just yourself. I need to get out.
Bro, I didn't realize this thing existed. Like, I didn't think anyone would be crazy enough to do something like that.
Completely under the radar.
That's unbelievable.
You can follow it online now. There's even live timing, which is a shame, because when I first did it, you didn't get the results for almost 2 weeks.
Yeah,
it
right.
took that long to compile. So you come home and
that's
it's like
South Australia for you, by the way. Yeah,
10 days later, mate rings, oh, they've posted the results. But it was just like, it was kind of cool because you didn't know where you were during the race. Where now, you know, you got people at the pit stop and you see them, they're on the phone, and you can say, oh, you know, and it's sort of good, but I guess it's good. You can back off or push harder. I mean, imagine if you finish it and you missed out on the win by 10 seconds. You'd be like, oh, I remember that time I stopped to scratch my ear or something. So, but yeah, I love it. And so each pit stop or each stage, each control, I should say, a lot of the controls are run by local bike clubs or camps. And, you know, some, it's been the same group there for 50 years, you know. Like on social media the other day, one of the guys was like, oh, we'll have some slow cooked beef at, you know, control number 9. We'll make sure there's some for you if you're on time and stuff like that. Like some of these camps have got over 100 people at them. The big camps are huge, massive bonfires, and they're out partying. So you go through the first lap and, you know, it's the afternoon and everyone's on the cans, and then you go through the second lap and it's midnight and people, and then lap 3, it's like just a couple of the hardiest, usually the women in, sitting there in sleeping bags at the control, clicking your time, your number, it's transponders, it's saying, hey, you going, love? Everyone's crashed out. Then you go through on the last lap and everyone's rolling up their swags.
Could they pick like maybe put in like spring or autumn? They have to put it bang in the middle of the winter. It is the hardest time.
So we rode, myself and my best mate Donnie, 2 years ago, we rode Triumph 1200 Tigers as a promotion exercise for Triumph. So it's full enduro, single trail tech.
Yeah.
And we rode these 1200 Adventure, and we rode them there. And it's just a bit more of a challenge.
This is mind-boggling.
This is craziness.
I thought you had a team of 5 when you told me you were doing it.
Yeah, like that year, just, I don't know where I was going with that, but we rode over on these Triumphs to do it, but it was, it got to -4. So that was crazy. Like the grass was like, you know, over a metre high on a 45-degree angle, just white, frozen on the side of the track. I remember one
section. The logs are wet. So I see logs.
And you go through your techs, you do your technicals. Say you do a 12, 14K special test. Like absolute balls to the wall, flat out.
Mm.
You come out the other side, you're dripping, and then you've got a 20K road, dirt road transit. And, you know, you're sitting on 100 and it's frost, and because you've been sweating. Yeah. So that's the hardest part is your gear.
Yeah.
You're so hot and you're so cold.
Yeah.
So these technicals, talk me through it. So is it just full tight single trail, hard enduro? Is there many hill climbs?
No hill climbs, because it's pretty flat country. There's a few hills, little pinches.
Yeah.
A lot of dry creek beds, so you're dropping in and out of dry creek beds.
Yeah.
A lot of rocky ones, like the other year we were going up when we had the Triumphs up, so a lot of rock ledges. Not on an enduro bike, nothing that's going to stop you, but when you're pushing hard and real deep pebble rock beds, by the time you get a couple of hundred competitors a couple of laps through,
yeah,
the ruts are, you know, a couple of feet deep, and really, so yeah, it's tough riding. Yeah. It's all riding that just your average trail rider would get through, but riding it through the middle of the night at speed, it's
How's visibility like in the middle of the night with being tired? Like I'm lost for words.
The hardest thing is, of course, enduro bikes have got just enough electrical power to run a pissy little light. It's we're doing it easy since they brought in EFI. It's so much better.
Okay,
before it was like getting stators rewound and trying to get a bit more power out, you know. But even now, like, it was interesting. I've just wired up. I'm riding my own bike. Normally I do it someone else's and do a story on it. But this year, my own Gas 250 Enduro two-stroke. But I've got a headlight from a couple of years ago, and my new one is half the weight and almost double the light, the same power. So technology helps. So you're the rules are you're allowed, you have to have one road legal high-low headlight, road legal, and you're allowed one single spotlight. So we just run like one driving light. So you make up custom brackets, and there's a bit of work goes, but everyone runs that. But they're still like, for an enduro bike, it's a bullshit amount of light, which is good. But at speed, you need every bit of more, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
There's no lights on your helmet. You're not allowed that. Yeah.
Do you just get to like 3 a.m, freezing cold, and just think, why am I doing this?
Usually before 3. You do. You're just like, why? Why? And I ask that every time, but I'm a sucker for going to
punishment.
I like it.
Yeah.
There's something about it. Although, you know, even said to my missus last year, like at the end of lap, she'll chase me around with the kids till near midnight in the four-wheel drive. Like, say, go to different stages. A lot of people do. So they'll watch me come through somewhere or see me at a checkpoint, say good day, or they come up to where I'm refueling and over the fence, they'll yell out, you know, encouragement. It's an adventure for them. I've got a couple of mates. One of my best mates does it. His daughter's the same age as ours. So we do it sort of as a family trip too. But I said to my missus last year, don't let me do this again. Don't tell me how shit it is, because I'm dying here. But then
Jeez.
The time takes about a week after it's finished and you're like, oh, I reckon next year.
They could do that again,
I'll try this. I'll improve. So to me, it's just off the radar, the most grassroots.
Isn't it?
It's just the hundreds of volunteers that sit up all night. It's a religion over there.
How many competitors? How many enter?
They cap it at 170, but this year it's a centenary, so I think they've got 260. So this year they've got 50 off-road sidecars, and they're full-blown proper motocross sidecars. And that's what I rode last year. I rode sidecar last year just to do something different, but they destroy the track. So this year, I'm just like, sidecars go first. I'm like, it's going to be hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be good. It'll be fun. I'll post plenty of updates.
Yeah, we'll be following, we'll be following for sure.
I seriously did not know something like this existed. Yeah, and especially in Australia as well. Like,
I thought we're pretty good at keeping our ear to the ground for all this type of stuff.
Yeah, it goes under the radar. I did a thing for ADB a few years ago, magazine, you know, because even they say, oh, we've got no South Australian content, you know, but it's just one of those things that just goes under the radar. And I think a lot, you know, they're not fussed about it being a big deal. It's,
yeah, they probably like that, I suppose.
It's their big
yeah.
deal, but, and I mean, the top guys there are top, you know, there's some guys that go very well in AORC and all that sort of stuff. So they're the top handful. But then, you know, like the other year, there was a guy starting a few bikes behind me. He's a farmer on an old DT200 Yamaha. He just does one race a year and that's it.
He must be hard as nails, that fella.
Some of these guys, like, they are some tough, tough characters there.
Yeah,
like,
we want to look at him the wrong way, that's for sure. Christ.
He'd be Ronnie Mack style with a flannelette and overalls.
There's some of that. There really is. They just do it. You know?
No thermals, nothing, no, I reckon. Nothing.
Don't know about that, but yeah, they probably. Yeah, it's just. It is a bit of a different breed, you know. You go through some pretty. Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, it sounds it. Are you keeping up to date with MotoGP, World Superbike, still watching all that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how can you not? The racing's been so good at the moment. Yep. I mean, we're going to see Top Rack go to MotoGP.
Oh, that'd be cool.
I think that's a really exciting one.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just the series in itself and watching Pecco dominate, I think it's just beautiful to watch at the moment, looking how well he's riding. And
it's incredible, isn't it?
Seeing all the rider changes too. I mean, things are going to change up for next year, but I mean, MotoGP, you wonder how it can get much better, really. It's just, it seems to be working at the moment, certainly putting on the spectacle. Just be good to have an Aussie up the front, but anyway, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, never know. You never know. There's a few young stars coming through as well. We've had them on the pod, Jacob, Joel, Senna, they're doing really well.
They are, they're doing really well. It's just so hard to make that transition. And I don't know too, you know, like, you look at Moto 2, going well in Moto 2 doesn't guarantee you're going to go well on a Moto GP. But we've seen riders do nothing in Moto 2. And then, who was it? Was it Zarco? No, it wasn't Zarco.
Quartararo.
Of course, Quartararo.
Yeah.
You know, and then got so, and that's the cruel thing. And we don't really see anyone go from Superbike now. And that's why it'd be really cool. I think it'd be a big challenge. Probably the Pirelli tyre to the Michelin's would be the biggest difference. But I mean, mate, if you can ride a bike, you can ride a bike.
Yeah.
Like,
that's right. He'll make it work.
Oh, I reckon it'd be ace to see. I don't know. I haven't checked the last couple of days. There's any more updates, but yeah, it seems like he wants to go there. Surely someone's got to have a seat.
They'll make room for him.
Just
you would think so.
From a sponsors and for MotoGP, to have a Turkish rider, too. Like, it's a big audience.
He's got a big following as well, Top Rack.
Huge.
Massive.
You know, even when with Philip Island for World Supers this year, there's heaps of Turkish people there.
He's the man by far. Yeah. I'd even, like, people would flock to him before they'd flock to Ian Oni.
Yeah, 100%.
You know what I mean? Now, probably besides the fact that he's a bit of a, you know, not a nice person.
Yeah. You could say it. He's a bit of a prima donna.
He's a chooch.
He's a chooch, yeah. He's a bit of a chooch.
But yeah,
Daniel's allowed to say that.
I'm allowed to say that. You know, he's my cousin.
He's got chooch privileges.
Yeah. Got C-pass. he was the man, though. Like, everyone flocked to him and everyone loved him. Obviously, Remy as well being the home race, but... Yeah, he was the man.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Well, we'll see what happens there, but yeah, so it's definitely exciting times, and I think that the big shake up to it, KTM and Aprilia, I think that's going to be very interesting to see what some different riders on that Aprilia do, because I think that bike, I think we're all wondering, you know, we know how good Pol is, and we know how good
Aleix?
Yeah, sorry, Aleix, and I'm thinking of Vinales.
Yeah,
we know how good they are, but yeah, to see some other riders on, I think, will be interesting.
Yeah, Jorge Martin's proven.
That's going to be interesting, and it's going to be like so important for Aprilia as well. If Martin goes, their team does nothing. They got to make some changes as well to the bikes.
They've got a point to prove. He's got a massive point to prove. I mean, he's going to be pissed at Ducati. He wants to get. It's personal, you know. Yeah. It's good. Yeah. It's got all the ingredients to be epic, I think.
Yeah, that's all right.
Two questions I've got for you, Cam. Favorite corner on the TT circuit and your biggest moment on the TT circuit?
Favorite corner, to be honest, it's a bit of a difficult one because it varies a bit year to year and bike. It really does. Like a corner like
Bellascari.
Yeah, Bellascari. And then after that, you got Crosby's left hander. And even that, like every time you come up to it, you know where you've got to be, but that mental fight of just trying to hold the throttle open, you see some amazing shots. There's a really good one of Pete Hickman going through there the other year. It's like literally 180 miles an hour with the thing just so crossed up. Mm. Like, yeah, Crosby, yeah, Bellascari, those big ones, as I said, every lap, no matter how long you're racing, you can be winning races at that level, but every time that mental fight of just... And you think you're holding it 100%, and then you come in and they look at the data and they're like, oh, no, you're back to like 88. You're just cracking it a bit. Even though in your head you would swear your life.
And you've never had a – like it's – I bet a lot of people would say I've never had a perfect lap. Like there's always there's always time to find.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. And that's the beauty about it. You're just trying to get the best. And that's why even when you come in, you know, Philip Island, you come in, oh, the bike's running right, turn 12, or it's understeering here, or – where the TT, it's more about, I just need it to work. Like, you need stability. Mm-hmm. You want it a bit here, a bit there. And it's always a compromise. And I see a lot with more lesser experienced riders.
Favourite corner and... biggest moment. I want to know, like, a moment in your career at the TT where you thought, ooh, that was super close.
I reckon the biggest was I was on a Honda and something just didn't feel right. And I was in a race that, you know, we should have been... Oh, we're definitely in contention for winning, if not a podium. And from lap one, something felt wrong within... It didn't take long. Knew something was wrong and I ended up pulling up at Ramsey Hairpin and jumping off the bike and I was looking at the front and I kicked the calipers and, like, I'm looking. I said, grab a bike to a marshal. I'm like, something's wrong. I already know my race results just going down the chute with stopping. But I thought, something's wrong. Couldn't see anything. Jump back on the bike. And I was coming up the mountain mile and the front just felt really unstable. So I just buried the throttle into it. I thought, I'll get more weight on the front. So, you know, you're pushing, really fast up the top there, like 280 sort of Ks an hour. And I had a massive wobble of the front and ran wide, like right to the white line. And on the outside of the road, it's a really deep gutter into a bank. And I was on the white line. It was really like a proper... Life flashes before your eyes kind of thing. But you know, I pulled in and I just said, something's wrong with the bike. I think I've lost my nerve. And I was sitting in the truck saying to Kaz, I don't know, something just doesn't feel right, just don't know. I remember my crew chief saying, get that tyre out, get straight down to Dunlop, get it off a rim, maybe there's something wrong with the tyre or this, that, the other. And then next thing, someone calls out Cam, we walk out and the front front mudguard, the bolts had snapped off the front. So at speed, the mudguard was lifting up.
So you didn't see it. Obviously, you didn't see it.
Every time you stopped, the mudguard fell back into place.
Of course.
And just the whole aerodynamics of the bike would just,
And I just think things like that in hindsight, you think, you know, if I buried it into the bank, would have ended up wearing my bloody arsehole as an eye patch.
Yeah.
And the bike would have been in 200 pieces. And I always think, I wonder if they would have worked out it was a mudguard. They probably thought, oh, you're just pushing it to it, you know. And
100%
that,
though.
And at the time, they used to think, well, it doesn't matter anyway, you know. But the more you think about it, and that's things like that, the longer you race there, the more that becomes a challenge, the more it eats at you, you know. But, yeah, that was without doubt the biggest moment.
Yeah.
But there's been quite a few.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I mean,
most of them you blank out.
Did you ever
out.
Come off?
Yeah, only that year when I
ran wide on the in this grass.
So I dislocated my shoulder, which was a shame because it was all to play for, and I wasn't pushing particularly hard on that lap. It was the last night of practice. I'd set the 131 mile an hour lap on Thursday. Superbike race was Saturday. We had a team meeting, and I was like, I don't even want to go out Friday. I don't need to. Just put me on that bike, and they're not going to say which way we went. So confident. And I thought, and it'll do everyone else's head in Friday if I don't go out. You know, I just thought, this is just perfect. And then Friday we decided, oh, take the Superstop bike out. That race is Monday. Take it out with new brake pads and a chain. Just do one lap, familiarise yourself. Two, it's a long time off the bike. So, and I remember going out and doing the lap, and halfway around the lap, conditions were a bit, there was a few damp patches. And I was coming down the mountain, not pushing, and just didn't go down three. Went down two gears instead of three into a corner, ran wide a bit. And there was a grass verge, and you know, if there was a wall there, I would have made the corner because you have to. But I thought, oh, I'll pick it up. And as soon as I hit the grass, it was like a hole in the grass and just lost the front cartwheel. Dislocated shoulder. So that's – and the TT was over. But, yeah, it can grab you very easy. But, everyone has – I mean, you have moments. The amount of times you run wide or clip curves, like it happens when you're pushing. And not much of it gets missed now, which is really cool because we've got onboards and got and it's funny because sometimes you have these moments and you think, oh – didn't feel that big, and then you see the footage, you're like, shit, I was really, really lucky there. Or the other way, it can feel really bad and it doesn't look that bad on camera, but normally it does.
Crazy.
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's just...
Well, I remember, I know this is so, like, silly to talk about, but I remember playing the game.
Yeah.
Remember the TT game that came out?
Yeah, it was addictive, that game, and, like, trying to get a good lap time.
We couldn't complete the lap without coming off on a game, yeah? So... And I'm thinking of these guys, like, ducking in and out, trees, cover, shades, grass. I'm like, these are the...
Weather.
Don't feel bad. I can barely do it. I can't do a lap without crashing, and I've won there. So that game's terrible. It just turned my freaking head in. So every time I crash, it'd just be like this mental, oh, my God.
True,
But no, that game actually came out the first year I went there, and it was good to help. I mean, definitely, I don't think there's a racer out there that hasn't used it for course familiarisation.
Yeah.
But just onboard laps, and that's nothing to... I tell newcomers or less experienced riders, you know, study a lap that's 130 miles an hour. Don't study Peter Hickman's lap record because you miss too much detail. Yeah. Even a slower lap, even 125, 120, one from 20 years ago, you get more detail because it's the same course. So,
have they made any changes to the course, or do you say exactly the same?
Look, it always changes.
Mm.
To be honest, it just seems to get bumpier and bumpier. But, you know, they'll resurface one corner and people, oh, that'll be far. What? How much? Percentage-wise, how much?
Yeah.
And then they have, like, the other year they had a really bad winter. And I think it was about 2 years where lap records didn't get broken because they're just not going faster because the course always gets bumpier. It seems to me, I mean, I did a parade lap this year, 40 years of Arrow helmets, and I rode an SP Fireblade and had spent a while, so it was pretty cool to do a lap. And I was like, wow, I couldn't believe how little I could see. Trees have grown over so many areas, and just it was quite sunny, and just that strobe effect coming through. And I couldn't believe how much of the track, even though I still know it well and I do a lot of laps in the car when I go over there, just studying for the commentary job. But so much, I was like, shit, I forget how little you can see. You're riding so much of this on just vague, like, memory and vague reference
instinct
points. And I mean, at speed.
Yeah.
And even in a parade lap, and I mean, I was having a dip, but it was still just like, poor. Just reminds me, like, respect. It really drove it home how hard it is to see and what you're up against.
Yeah, totally.
Is there any thoughts going through your head when you're riding at speed, or are you just completely in the zone where you're just locked in?
No, I mean, your mind winds. Sometimes you're up on the mountain, you start thinking, what am I going to have for dinner? Used to think, just for a split second, that was one thing that often came into my head.
That's so funny.
Food. But But no, really just their next section. And, you know, you blow a corner, like you might go a bit wide and you just got to know, you know, just forget that's done, next section, you just really – but you get lost in time, and that's why I used to – I'd always get a pit board about half a mile before the pits of what lap, because every two laps you come in for fuel and a tyre, depending on the bike, but always for fuel. And you forget, like, am I lap one, lap two, lap three? Like, okay. Because you're just so buried in the moment. So, and it was always a real fear of mine. Imagine riding past the pits and then thinking, oh.
Yeah, you're done.
Yeah.
That's it.
So you do get lost with a lot. But with your mind, if it starts to wander, you've just got to bring it back to next section, next section.
That's a discipline in itself, I reckon, trying to do that. Just bring your mind back into the actual play of it.
Superbike, it's like trying to wrestle a rocket, you know. The bike's just so fast, all it wants to do is go straight. You're fighting around there, and I've had races where the bike's not working the way you want it to. Lap one, you're dry in the mouth, your hands already hurting, you're fighting it, and you're just like, I've got to go another five and a half lap. Like, what? I'm not. So then you're just like, next thing you're on the last lap.
Yeah, it must just fly by with the concentration.
It takes forever, and all of a sudden you come out of that last corner and you're thinking, thank Christ, this is done, because I am done with this. Like, yeah, you know, you just... Yeah.
145 minutes of just solid concentration. Just, oh, it's crazy. And even the pit stops, they're quick pace, aren't they? Like, it's...
Yep.
Put the fuel in, out, like, within, what, a minute and a half, maybe?
Yeah, 40, 50 seconds. That's a cool thing. They use the same gravity. I don't know if they're the same, but it's the gravity-fed Bowsers they've been using for a long time.
Yeah.
A lot of people ask why, because, you know, I want to race at Le Mans. High-speed wheel changes, you know, all captive wheel stuff, in and out, and you couldn't fuel the bike unless everyone's standing back too. Where at the TT, you can fuel while they're working on it. But, you know, like... World Endurance, you're in and out 10, 12 set, whatever it is. It's ridiculous. But the TT, they want to slow it down for safety.
Yeah,
so makes sense.
It takes about 40-odd seconds to get the 20 litres of fuel in.
Mm.
So that takes the pressure off the wheel change.
Makes sense for sure.
There's roving scrutineers. So every single pit stop, there's a scrutineer
watching,
which sometimes not watching too closely, because when you're on the superbike, one of my brake pads fell out the back and the mechanic just kicked them under the... Armco back into the holding area, and he just was screaming at me in the helmet, do not use the back brake, do not use the back brake. I think I finished second or third in the superbike in that race. And I'm like, what? So I did, because when I come in, he was like, you fucking used it. And I was like, of course I did. But all I did was pump the pistons out and just, you know, I realized it wasn't working. But I did in the next two laps without a back brake, and I used a lot of back brake around there, more to keep the front wheel down, dabbing it.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so that was lucky. But things like that happen, you know. It's racing. It's motorsport. We're running in a potential for, you know.
You do anything, quick thinking mechanic. Yeah. And you're there once a year, you know. It's
That's it. You can be on form. You can lead every test. You can do everything. You can get sick. You can get just one little thing. It's a long time to wait, you know.
What's the you touched on before the camaraderie. What's the camaraderie like at the Isle of Man? And do you have like a wild after party or something after the event's done?
A lot of the guys party pretty hard.
I can imagine.
Peter Hickman's pretty amazing. Like, you know, even this year, the guys are saying they saw him at the Monster party at 3 a.m. and the next day's a rest day, but then the day after that, you're racing again.
Yeah.
You know, it takes me 2 weeks to get over 3 a.m. these days. But, you know, I was never big for partying. I save that for more of the off season when I come home with my mates. But yeah, you have a few beers. Even practice, because practice, it's a week of practicing, and they close the roads at 6 at night till 9, because it's daylight till after 10. You finish practice, you debrief, you get back to the house, your accommodation might be 10:30 at night. Only an hour ago you were doing 300 k's an hour, so I'd have a tin or two of beer or a glass of wine and just watch a bit of TV, which I don't even do at home, and just try to
calm down.
Yeah, okay. So it's a bit more relaxed like that. But yeah, when racing's done, you think I'm going to have a big night, but usually you tip in half a dozen pints and you're just destroyed. You literally just fall over. Yeah, so, but there is camaraderie, and the guys said we do look out for each other, and, you know, especially when you're staying in the paddock, you're there with those, it's 2-3 weeks really by the time you set up and pack up, so you get to know everyone pretty well. They're like, everyone looks out for each other.
Yeah.
You know, the girls are amazing too, the partners, you know, if a rider's crashed, you know, it's so full on in so many ways, but everyone really does look out for each other, because you know what's on the line.
Mm. That's cool.
It's good to see in motorsport, you know, because in so others, it's, I guess we talk about prima donnas and rock stars in MotoGP and all that. They just wouldn't survive in that environment. It's too real in some ways.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
taking nothing away from their ability. Their ability is incredible.
They've just been brought up around that glam and glitz, really.
And that's too, even with Aussie riders coming through now, you know, you've got to have a bit of grit. And a lot of riders now see just don't have that. And that you can teach people to ride and you can get riders that are really, really fast. But that last little bit of,
yeah,
you know.
See you next Thursday.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
You
can't teach it.
Yeah, you can't, you know. And if it's not there, and it's, and I've worked a lot, you know, when I raced in Asia, some really good talent over there, especially on smaller bikes. But when they get on the bigger bikes, they really seem to struggle. 600s, but thousands especially, and it's just that missing piece. And I don't know, a lot of it's just scary.
Yeah,
you know?
And that sets apart the guys that go on and win those championships and really dominate.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And then, because natural ability only take you so far, and you've still got to, you know, so you often say, you know, you got to want it. You got to want it more than the next guy.
It's very true. Like, we speak about it all the time, but you see world champions in all disciplines. Not just motorsport, but motorsport especially. You look at how ruthless Rossi, Marquez, Schumacher, Verstappen.
Verstappen on the weekend.
Yeah, they've all got a massive load of C-U-N-T in them, and that's just how it is.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean you don't have to be a nice guy. I mean, I always think I've got along with everyone, and, you know, Rossi is always a nice guy. You don't have to be, you know, nasty, but, you know, there's a time when you got to do the job, and you got to do the job.
Mm.
White line fever.
Yeah.
Pretty much what it is, eh? As
it is.
The helmet goes on.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep, and it's still, once that's in your blood, I mean, I've lost a lot of drive. You know, I'm happy now to go, just, you know, it took a while to learn how to turn off, but, you know, sooner or later life creeps in and you realise I don't want to wake up hurt, where before it was like I just don't care. It's just, you got to win.
Just gotta go,
so, you know, that happens, and that's age, I guess, in life. But unfortunately, you also get more experience, which is a benefit. So it's a trade-off, isn't it? If you can put that, you know, 40-year-old knowledge inside a, you know, 20-year-old mindset, that would be pretty hard to beat.
Yeah.
It's pretty full on.
Yeah.
Favourite bike you've ever ridden around the circuit?
Oh, without doubt, that Suzuki, the GSRV or whatever it was. Whatever the term.
Caparossi's?
Yeah, that was just epic. It was just so pure, just such a thoroughbred, just so fast, so lightweight. Little vibration, high revving, just everything about it was incredible. But apart from that, my 2008 super bike, that thing was just an animal.
Yep.
It was so angry. The motor spec that we ran, it was very similar to the Yoshimura spec that Matt Milladen was riding in the States at the time. Because a lot of it was Yoshimura parts and technology we were using. That thing was so angry. And it was just awesome to ride. Very little electronic interference. Like, we had traction, but nearly all that stuff was turned off. And they still, you know, Peter Hickman there, he runs nothing. Everything's turned off.
There you go.
Fine, it gets in the way a lot. Spends so much time off the ground.
Yeah.
It just cuts in where you don't want it to.
Yeah.
But it's just, yeah, wild. But, yeah, a bike like that, when I look back, it's just, yeah, it was brutal and beautiful in its rawness.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's cool to hear. I love it. Mm. Great insight.
Yeah, and that's where the TT is another thing, where it really is down to the rider more so than the machine than probably any other.
I think so.
Form.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so.
You know?
Yeah, I for sure.
So even if it's not evident. Working, you can ride past the machine a little bit. At the end of the day, you got to want it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you see riders like McGuinness, they're not the fittest people. Like, we have an inside joke of our podcast. Like, you see some ex riders, they blow out, so we call them Cheeseburger. Like, Cheeseburger Lorenzo.
Oh man,
Cheeseburger Barros.
Cheeseburger Barros is he lays down rubber because he's just heavy on the rear spring.
John's a freak. Like, he's 52 years old.
That's wild.
Look at the cut of him.
Yeah,
it pisses me off because I'm like, John, you're making us all look bad. You know what I mean? Like, how are people meant to take us seriously when you look like you've just escaped from the pie shop? Like, and he's a good mate. And, like, we race World Endurance together, shared motel rooms, and, yeah, funny dude. Like, and, like, you know, anyway, I'd say to him, when are you going to stop racing? Oh, I'm not. I'm just going to keep racing until I die. I'll just crash one day. I'll just be wiped out in a fireball.
Oh, my God.
He used to say that, and I'd be like, you can't say that, John. He'd just laugh. I haven't spoken about that sort of thing for a few years now, but he's so full on. But he is such a good motorcycle rider.
Mm.
And he's done a lot in short circuits. But like when I race for Honda, his throttle trace and input, Steve Plater, British, multiple British champion, and he was a factory rider, it was myself, Steve Plater, and John riding World Endurance. When they were overlaid and looking at our data, John was getting better fuel economy, myself or Steve. Steve was like 20 kilos lighter than John, and I was like 10 kilos lighter in between, or 12 or 14 or something. John was a lot fitter then. His throttle, well, he was lighter, but his throttle trace was like superhuman. He's pretty special, like the way he rides a motorbike. He's incredible. And he's bulk. He doesn't move much on the bike, and that works. Perfect example, him, Keith Moore, Scottish guy, really wiry, fit. They're both on factory Hondas, and I remember I caught up to them in a practice and we're coming up May Hill out of Ramsey, really corrugated right-hand uphill corner. Keith's bike's bouncing all over the road. John's just sitting on the – and all of a sudden that fat ass is keeping that bike where it needs to be.
It's got some advantages to it.
Most TT riders are big guys. I think Ian Hutchinson's the only real wiry guy that did it unbelievably well. Even Michael Dunlop, he's a nugget. He's strong. But coming back this year, parade lap. I did that parade lap. I come in. I've been riding motocross once a week, getting ready for the 24. I'm a concreter. I keep pretty fit.
Yeah.
I'm still fit in my race leathers. I'm only 2 kilos, 3 kilos – heavier than I was when I was riding for a living. Man, I was absolutely rooted. One lap on a brand new SP.
Sure.
I mean, I was probably hanging on and stressed out and, you know, but I said to John, I had him at a chat show the next night, interview him. I was like, dude, I'm not pissing in your pocket. Like, 52, your speed. But he had a couple of finishes just outside top 10 of British Superstock this year. Like, I mean, he still rides a lot, does all the factory testing. You know, he's going to Japan, he's doing this, he's doing that, but he's still so fast.
Yeah. Clearly.
Ridiculous. Yeah, 100%. It's crazy. It's a great insight, actually.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
So that's
Cheeseburger McGinnis.
Yeah. and then another time we're at Suzuka, Jason Halloran, Aussie, that's won British Championship. We're at Suzuka, it was myself, and Jace at the time, you know, chiseled, young. He was very young then, you know, just ripped. Aspiring BSB rider, factory Honda rider, young John, myself, somewhere in between the two. And like we came in over there, like we had a doctor with us or a physio, and they're like, John had the lowest core temperature. I couldn't believe it. Like, and when they were monitoring our
superhuman, this guy.
Yeah, he was. He was a freak.
Maybe it's the Guinness.
And I remember Jason O'Halloran just like going, he's what? And John's there like, does that mean I can have two desserts? That's what he said. So like, that's just, but anyway, talking about how special he is, but yeah, I don't think anyone else, you know. And
so I got a chance, you're saying.
Saw him this year in leathers. Looks like a bloody condom full of peanuts. And it's just like, but you know, we joke about it, but I shouldn't say it with disrespect because I mean, how fast he still is just.
No, that's right.
Get back out there every year.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But that knowledge and hasn't stopped riding. But he even said himself, I'm glad they're not more than 6 laps. He goes, I'm blowing, mate, on that last lap. I'm like, who's not?
Yeah, that's fair.
Ride fit is a different fit as well. Being ride fit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And even coming up to the 24, you know, I normally, you know, I ride the mountain bike a bit or paddle the kayak in the river or whatever. I don't do anything. I just ride.
Mm.
Just go out and just ride because that's all you need to. Mate's doing it this year for his first time and he's like, oh, mountain bike. He's older than me, but he's super fit dude and climbs and does all this. He's action man. But I'm like, just ride the bloody motorbike, mate. Don't worry about anything else. Don't worry about crossing. Just ride and ride and ride because that's all you're going to be doing.
Yeah.
Saddle time.
Yep.
Now, Cam, thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it.
What a chat. That was amazing. Unreal.
Incredible. Now, it wouldn't be a Republica episode if we don't at least hand over a gift. So I've got a special little gift for you.
One of one.
One of one.
Always one
thanks
of one.
Thanks to Stace from HJC.
Oh, no way.
As always.
How cool is this? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Stacey, from McLeod Accessories, HJC Australia.
Oh, thank you very much. Yep. I was wearing HJC back in the day in Asia. They're a good lid.
Yeah. Open it up. Hang on.
Need three arms. But no, thanks for having us on, guys.
No, you know, really appreciate it.
It's obvious how much I hate a yarn, but I enjoy a chat. And when I get talking about the TT, I'm pretty passionate about it.
Oh, the passion is amazing, yeah.
No, like, anyone that wants to go, said I work, you know, sort of shameless plug, Sportsnet. They're an Aussie-based, Melbourne-based tour company, specialise in, you know, World Cup and big events. But I've been working with them 10 years now on their TT tours. Oh, that is factory. Got the black and got your mugs on the front of it. Yep. How am I meant to see through that?
Personally, personally
signed. Oh, with a memento on the top.
That's a collector's item.
Yeah, so. Thanks, boys.
We don't
that's
want
really
you to
cool.
ride it.
I've got a helmet collection at home that'll go up on the.
Oh, thanks,
beautiful.
Mate.
Left you a little message. Now, where can we watch and where can the listeners watch this South Australian 24-hour race? We need to know.
Look up South Australian 24-hour trial. I think it's the Hardy sponsoring Hardy 24-hour trial. But if you Google 24-hour trial, you'll find it online. There's live timing and there'll be updates. And I'll be on my own social media doing posts during the night and with the lead up. So, yeah, it's a wacky event. But if you ever want a camping trip and some, like, it doesn't get more grassroots.
Yeah.
And Australia is so cool that we've still got some really cool.
Yeah.
You know, probably a bit like Targa Tasman. You know, we've got some really iconic different stuff, and unfortunately it all seems to be disappearing over the years, but this year's the 100th anniversary. So,
And what's the concreting business?
Just me. Look me up on the... I don't even just Cam the Concreter.
It's Cam the Concreter.
Yep. Get your driveway done, everyone. I'm sure it needs
if
to be
you
done.
Want, do plenty of exposed aggregate and decorative
like
finish and all
ag.
That.
Yeah,
everyone does
that.
These days.
Yeah, we love that.
You'd be all over it.
Oh, yeah.
Even more that can go wrong.
Got to put the green in and spray it off and, yeah.
But I love it. So,
that's good.
And it's amazing how many... Yeah, as I said, you meet motorsport people in general are just... They're good people. You've always got more in common than just motorsport.
Yeah.
That's what I love about it and why so many of our customers end up being it. But as I said, sports, and if anyone wants to go to the TT, you know, just go. They're a great way of doing it. But if not, do it yourself. You know, so many people go, oh, I want to go. I hear yourselves saying it, guys. But do it because I reckon about 90% of the people that I know have gone back again.
Well, your dad's gone twice.
Yeah, my old man went twice. Yeah, he loved it.
To me, I'm not a religious person, but it's like Mecca.
It's
like a holy pilgrimage. You go there. It's not just the racing. People all around the world, and everyone you bump into, you just be in a bar, you bump into a German. Oh, yeah, I've been since my grandfather. You bump into someone from England, France, other Australians, whatever. It's just, there's so much more there, and everyone's got a story.
You know? I think my old man tied you up at one point in the Isle of Man when he was last there and having a good chat to you. I think my uncle as well. So
Dave Superbike Shaw,
shout out.
He would have told you all about himself. So.
That's the weirdest thing. You meet people over there and you met them from home or you haven't and you don't know where. And when you're there, all you're thinking about is the track or the race. So you're just like,
That's
interesting. It's
He was telling me today, but we will wrap up. But we had a poster since I was a kid. We had a poster of you signed in our garage wall.
Awesome.
Yeah.
No way.
I'll have to get a photo up.
We'll put it up. We'll clip it in.
Yeah. It was.
You would have only probably been about 10 years old then.
I was 100% in primary school.
Time passes quickly.
Dynabike.
Yeah. No way. Back in the day, Dave Dynabike. He's still going.
Yeah. Right, there you go. Yep. See. There's a plug for you.
That's Dave. He's a great guy, and I wrote that bike off and they still gave me another bike to race. Yeah, no, that was that was first year racing a superbike in Australia, which was remember it when you never forget your first year on a superbike.
I like it. I love it.
God, amazing chat. Thanks, Cam.
On that note, let's go.
Yeah, I love
thanks,
it.
Cam.
Thanks. Cheers, thanks, mate. Boys, thanks, for having Cam. Us on.
All
absolute
good,
ripper.
No worries.
Hey, Roo.